This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by NobleKnight.com, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
My name is Harley Stroh, and I'm the line editor for the Goodman Games Dungeon Crawl Classics. And you are about to enter the dungeon of the Vorpal Network. Snickeder snack. Roll for initiative.
Hey, this is Mike Merles, lead developer of 4th Edition, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 129. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I'm going to use the powers of my mind to summon forth a party of savage beasts, living crystals, lithe alien things, and manifestations of living nature to talk about The Player's Handbook 3. First, let's introduce our guest for today. First up is regular contributor to the show, all-around decent guy, and I heard he's a rumor he might be a Minotaur, Will Wong. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hello.
Is it true? Are you a Minotaur?
I have no comment on the Minotaur. No comment. although the decent guy thing is obvious slander.
Well, I'll try not to spread that around. Secondly, we also have with us writer and editor of the At Will blog, where I am starting to do some writing myself here and there. I can't promise he's a decent guy because I've actually heard he's a kind of bit of animated crystal living thing. But he does know a thing or two about D&D, even for a shard mind, Quinn Murphy.
Hey, and now I'm turning into a shard swarm, and now I have combat advantage on everyone listening to this right now. So watch out.
And you get to teleport.
And it's great to be back.
Good to have you back. So today we're talking about Player's Handbook 3, and if things go according to plan, this episode will actually be releasing the same day that the book comes out. So I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that we can pull this sort of thing off. It's not very often that that we get to do this kind of thing, but the Wizards Premier stores managed to get copies of the book early, and so I have a copy of the book early myself. Beyond that, I've also been doing some writing around the internet. I posted my text review recently of Underdark over at Fistful of Comics and Games, and I'm working on some other product reviews, including Player's Handbook 3, Marshall Power 2, and the Pirate King novel. Plus, I understand that before too long, you'll be able to read my article about giving your characters more character over at the At Will blog. Right, Quinn?
Yep, it's going to be awesome. It's coming soon this month. It should be pretty awesome.
Very cool. I look forward to seeing my name in print on another website. Also, last night I happened to have recorded an interview with the creator of The Forgotten Realms, Ed Greenwood, for a piece that's going to be on the Gamers Haven podcast, but I'll be sure to cut a little segment out of the audio for that and play it for the Tome Show listeners as well, to at least give you an idea if you want to head over to Gamers Haven and hear the rest of it. And Ed Greenwood,
I'm so remarkably jealous of you, by the way.
Ed Greenwood is a fantastic person to talk to. One of the easiest interviews ever, right? Because he's really good at telling stories, and he has a history in radio, so you can ask him a question and then just sit back for 15 minutes and let him go. And he tells great stories.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And this is the
Yeah, and then you can always say, tell me something about the Forgotten Realms.
Yeah.
And
he'll go.
Boom. Yep. Like, yeah.
This is the third time I've actually had a chance to talk to him, and every time I feel like I get a little bit of a different angle on his take on things, and I find it very interesting. But other than that, there's a little bit of D&D news, not a lot, although the new D&D Encounters program is starting up very quickly. In fact, by the time you're listening to this, the first one may have already happened. So if you're looking for some organized play that happens on, I believe, Wednesdays, with some possible rewards while delving into the dungeons under Waterdeep, you should check with your local store to find out about that. I know, Will, aren't you going to participate in the D&D Encounters program?
Yes, I'm going to attempt to play a monk, but I never, ever get to play a striker, so I figure I'll end up playing something else.
Quinn, do you ever get to do any of the organized play stuff?
Like, I've done some game days. I really want to try out this new format, the D&D Encounters, so I'm going to try and get my butt over to the game store and try that on Wednesday if my schedule allows.
Yeah. These are the kinds of things that I always feel like I would really enjoy in theory, and occasionally when I make it to a game day or something, it's a lot of fun and I wish I could do it more often. But then I realize, oh wait, no, I'm a teacher and a father and a husband, and I just can't dedicate, you know, a day in the middle of the
week
to that kind of thing. Well, any hours, because that 2 hours, it means that I don't get to make dinner and get to see my son in the afternoon that day. So
right. How old is your son?
He's 4.
So he probably couldn't play with you.
No. No, someday. Okay. Someday I'll make it to these things and it'll be a family event.
Mm-hmm. But I tried.
But in any case, in this episode, we're going to look at Player's Handbook 3 by Mike Merles, Bruce R. Cordell, and Robert J. Schwab. The book seems to be intended to introduce a new power source, the psionic power source, sort of how the Player's Handbook 2 gave us the primal power source. And it also, along the way, hands out some new options for some divine and primal characters as well. We're going to examine to see if the book succeeds at making the psionic power source something that we want to play. We'll check if the new options for divine and primal are useful. And we'll look at all the other new rules and races and other things that come along with this that make us discuss, maybe is it worth buying the book, or should we just wait for the compendium update on D&D Insider next month to get all this through the website. But before we get into all that, with Player's Handbook 3, I want to let you know about NobleKnight.com, the sponsor for this episode. They are a local game store and an online game store where you can get your new books and find old ones that you may have been looking for to complete your collection. My pick for this episode actually comes from David Nett, the man who brings us the web series Gold. In Gold, there's a team of pretty serious gamers, and one of them uses a pretty serious set of dice that are scientifically designed for more precision. This specific set is the Diamond Dice Set by Game Science. It's available at Noble Knight for $23, which is a little more than $4 off the standard price. And if you decide to head over to NobleKnight.com, be sure to let them know that the Tome Show sent you.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.nobleknight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Okay, so let's dig into it. We're going to go relatively in order with the book, but we've got some different themes and things that we're going to talk about specifically. First of all, comes the chapter on new races. We have the Githzerai, the Minotaur, the Shard Mind, and the Wilden. So, let's start with our Githzerai. What is a Githzerai? Who wants to tell me?
A Githzerai is, these guys go way back. Like, I think pretty much, you know, Matt Cummings, the Mythalot. Yeah, all the way back to first edition. I remember seeing them in the Fiend. They came out in the Fiend Folio, if I'm not mistaken. These guys are all basically, they're sort of the nice guy, in a sense, half of a race that was enslaved by the Mind Flayers and eventually won their freedom. The other half being, of course, the ever-awesome Githyanki. I really want a Githyanki. Can I just say, I really want a Githyanki. But I will take...
Everybody I play LFR with wants a Githyanki.
Yeah. I mean, everyone needs a pet Githyanki, but, you know, the Githzerai are cool, and these guys are more, while the Githyanki are more, you know, warlike raiders, the Githzerai are contemplative, more thoughtful, introspective.
Sure.
Is that more?
They're sort of the an astral planner race with a lot of, I don't know, martial traditions and almost, you know, a race full of monks. You know, they seem to be very designed to be good monks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They always were, as far as mythology and culture and everything. They've always been written up to be monks, even in second edition when there weren't monks till the very end.
Right. But they were very sort of introspective and focused and very monk-like in their descriptions all along the way. I've always loved the race myself. I think this incarnation is pretty darn good as well. They get some cool effects. You know, a bonus to saves against some of the most troublesome effects in the game, right? Like daze and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
A free shift when you use a second wind, a bonus to initiative modifier, which I haven't seen in any other races before. It's a pretty nice package. You know, you don't get a lot of the real flashy sort of things that some other races might get, but what you do have is really mechanically solid, and I could see it being very useful.
Yeah, instead of getting, like, one defining big thing, they gave the Gusari a lot of nice, like, smaller but very nice little things.
Mm-hmm.
And that works, too.
Now, there's one thing that
I'm not really impressed with their power.
You're not impressed with their power?
Yeah, I'm not impressed with the race power. Maybe it's really awesome and you just got to see it in action, but on paper, it doesn't seem very impressive to me.
Well, and it's not... It's a little bit like the dwarf racial power, right? It's not real flashy, but it looks like it could be really useful, you know? Because and I think the key for it is that it's an immediate interrupt. Instead of a reaction, it's somebody hits you with an attack. Okay, great. I use this as an immediate interrupt. I get a +2 to my defenses. Maybe now they just didn't hit, you know? If you just barely got hit, you can use this, yep. and now a bunch of things are missing you.
But the thing that triggers it is being hit. So if you use this, are you still hit?
I suppose that's
no, because it's an interrupt.
Yeah, it's a little questionable.
No,
right?
The interrupt will, like, you're hit by the attack, and then you interrupt it and go, okay, you basically sort of, like, rewind just before there, and then you can apply that to the defense, and then you know, you basically sort of put it on this stack, resolve this power, then resolve the attack.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use it for... So you can use it for, like, defense right on the fly. So it's pretty nice. It's not, like, the best thing ever. But, again, they get so many nice little things that it all adds up. Like, the bonus on initiative, yeah. I thought was really nice.
Yeah, and I agree.
And then they get a bunch of cool...
I think the Gizrai is built very much like you're discussing, right? It has a lot of little things that are really cool. None of them are big, you know, wow, I got to take this race for this power. No, it's I got to take this race because they have these four things going on, all of which sort of add up to a cool thing. So if they did have a really cool power, I think you could make an argument that they're too powerful, that they're unbalancing. But because they have all these other cool things going on, a small little power, I think, is just about right for him.
Now that Quinn has explained that it you can use it to stop a hit, that is pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I do notice with the Gisrai that holds true with all of the races in this book is that they seem to be taking a different approach to ability score modifiers. Every single race in this
book... Yeah, I noticed that too.
Yeah, every single race in the book has a +2 to one stat... And then a choice between two other stats for your second bonus. So, for example, in the Gisrai, you have a +2 to wisdom, and then you can get a +2 either to dexterity or to intelligence. And that's how every single one of these is built. Is that just – did they decide that maybe they were too stringent with the ability modifiers in the past and they're going to do it this way from now on?
I think
I'm thinking they're going to keep doing it from this way. It's probably just a result of people looking at, well, what two stats does this race get? It gets, you know, it gets wisdom and con. Well, nothing hits with con, so it's going to be divine. Mm.
It's a way to pigeonholing a race into a certain class.
Whatever other cool stuff the dwarf gets, a lot of dwarves end up being divine because they're a wisdom race.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that makes sense. On the other hand, I also wonder, does that mean that the old races now are a little bit less powerful because you don't have those options, you know? Should they go back and
rank on those?
Well,
I wouldn't mind that.
All right, one at a time.
Yeah. The older races seem to have better abilities.
Uh-huh.
And so maybe that's a compensation for it. Maybe that's purposely, so, you know, giving that variability, but making the powers less on these races.
Okay.
Possibly as a balance.
Sure. I think that might be fair. And I think maybe you just have to accept that some of the older races aren't going to have that flexibility, but you can still build good characters because we have a large slew of classes at this point that can be built in different ways. So you can still build a lot of cool characters from any given race. So the next race on the list is the Minotaur. I found that the Minotaur, and I think most people are generally familiar with Minotaurs, right? They're humanoids that with, you know, some sort of bull-like appearance, right? They've got a bull's head and the horns and they're big muscular warrior types. I thought it was interesting that they found a way to sort of make a Minotaur that, and partially because of this flexibility in ability scores, your Minotaur can either be the civilized Roman sort of Minotaur that you have in Dragonlance, or they can be the savage barbarian Minotaur that you have in a lot of other settings. You know, and so I thought it was interesting they managed to sort of make it so we can give you one set of statistics for the Minotaur and you can build it either way successfully.
Mm-hmm. Is that where the Roman Minotaurs came from, is Dragonlance?
Well, that's my first experience with them. I mean, the Minotaur originally was what?
I just never knew.
Yeah, the Minotaur originally was, I believe, what, Greek myth?
Yes.
So,
I'm pretty sure.
Now, the one thing that I question with the Minotaur is that the Minotaur seems to be all about the charge. You know? If you're not...
Okay.
They have three sort of abilities that are above and beyond, you know, or significantly different enough from what other races are getting that make them unique. And most of those, or two of those three abilities are all based on using a charge, which is fine and all, but it's also pretty limiting to what, you know, this kind of character is going to sort of synergize with and match with really well. To the point that I don't know that I'm personally that interested in it because I just, how often do I do charging that I really want to have all this cool charge stuff I can do?
Well,
Quinn, go.
Yeah, I mean, one can say that you pick a Minotaur because you get really into the charge kind of stuff. You know, they try and make it a little diverse on the Goring charge. They let you pick strength, constitution, dexterity. But, you know, hopefully when you make that choice to make the Minotaur, you're sort of expecting to do the stuff. You know, if you didn't want to use it, you probably don't want to do that. You know, because that's pretty much, I mean, as you're pointing out, it's pretty much what the Minotaur's got, mm-hmm. right? You know, you want to charge things, hit them, knock them down, laugh at them, stand over them, you know, all sort of Minotaur.
Hit them with your big axe.
But
yeah, and there are some barbarian builds that would work well with it, I think.
A Minotaur barbarian just seems I remember when I saw this and I was looking over the prowess, I'm just like, Minotaur barbarians are just going to be frightening.
Well, and I don't know why you would necessarily do anything else with a Minotaur, would you? It seems hand in glove made to fit with the barbarian, didn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean it definitely
fits. Yeah.
Although I wouldn't mind seeing that rune priest.
Yeah.
A Minotaur rune seems like it'd be fun.
Sure. Will, you had something you were going to say?
And they're sort of mealy. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was just agreeing that the Minotaur does seem almost ridden to be a barbarian.
Okay, cool. Well, let's move along so we don't end up going for hours and hours, as much as I could just pour over each one of these in detail. The Shard Mind is next on the list, and this is a wholly new and unique race to Dungeons & Dragons. It's not based on anything else that I've ever heard of. And they're basically... They're living constructs like a Warforge, but they're not big metal things. They're actually made out of crystal. You know, they're living crystal with a lot of psionic or abilities. You know, telepathy and that kind of thing. I look at the Shard Mind and I think, this is a really cool concept that I would have a lot of fun maybe playing, but I so don't know how I'm going to fit this into my game or my setting. You know, it just doesn't flow real well with the story of my world. You know, so it's on one hand, it's really cool and I want to play one. And on the other hand, it's like, but what does that do to my world? You know, what is that? How does that change my existence now?
You could just have them fall to Earth. There could be explosion of the living, the destruction of the living gate could happen. There's this big explosion in the sky, and then crystal fragments rain down, and some of them form up into humanoid form and start wandering around.
Yeah, you could do that as a major part of your story. I guess the approach I'm probably going to take with it is that if somebody wants to play one, then you're unique. You know, I think I kind of have to take that approach to it. Unless I want to make them a major part of my story, I have to just sort of take the approach of this is so different than anything else we've seen. I kind of just have to say, if you're going to be one, that's fine. And you explain why you're there and that's okay, but don't expect to see any more of your kind.
Well, how did you get Devas into your campaign?
Well, Devas are easy. Because they're specifically, I mean, their story very specifically is that there's very, very few of them. And they look very humanoid. You know, they could fit in fairly well with society.
Aren't there very few shard mines? Or does it not say?
I don't remember seeing if...
It doesn't really enumerate them. One assumes they're rare, but they don't just out and out say, you know, there's only two of these guys.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just my little that's what rolls around in my head when I see it. It's like, wow, this is cool. I want to play it, but it's really different. And how do I make it work in my world? So any other thoughts on the shard mine? I've sort of monopolized the discussion on that guy.
I like them. They get all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They get three, they get two plus two skills and then you choose one. They get a free language and they choose one. They get telepathy.
Mm-hmm.
All very cool.
Yeah, and I find it interesting that they get the extra languages and telepathy.
And telepathy.
It's like, well, what do you need all the languages for if you can just talk to people in their head?
Reading, I guess.
I suppose.
To yell at people? In the drawing, they have no mouth. So can they talk? Or do they have to get within 5 squares of you?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question. Mm. I mean, I suppose technically they can. But it would be an interesting role-playing situation if you said that, no, I can't, you know?
I
really like the fact that they did some – they made another living construct, and I thought that was cool. You know, the living construct concept has existed since 3rd edition, but it only ever applied to Warforged. You know, they created this whole concept that could be modular and moved around and apply to anything, but they've only ever actually done it with Warforged, and now they've come up with another race that uses it as well.
Mm-hmm. I like the shard mine. It's funny with the shard mine and the Wilden, especially. I like that they decided to go kind of weird. With this, you know, there's a bunch more well-established, safer kind of themes to pick than a shard mine in the Wilden. But I like that they went with these, and I think introducing the shard mine to a campaign is probably the biggest challenge, like you were sort of addressing. I think that's the only real inertia towards using them for me. The only thing I can think of is that you sort of have to introduce them as some sort of, again, like you were saying, like a world event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come from the Living Gate. You know, you could almost do them like a visitors kind of scenario where they come down and, hey, we come from the Living Gate, and sort of introduce themselves into the world. And you could also use them to bring in psionics too.
Sure.
They bring with them the gift of psionics.
Yeah, I had similar thoughts on the Wild and in the Shard Mind as well. Although I really like what you said sort of does make it more interesting to me, right? That they decided to do something weird and not, you know, they gave us two races that we were expecting, and then they created two things that were completely new and completely different than anything else that we might have expected.
And still no hippo men.
Which I'm kind of okay with. I really like Spelljammer, but I'm still not real fond of the GIF. So let's talk about the Wilden then. Who has some thoughts they want to share on the wild or not, since I monopolized so much of the last one?
I just don't get the nature's aspects.
You don't get how they work, or?
Oh, it just seems like when it's three facets of personality. It seems like a lot of bookkeeping for one, because your ability is constantly changing.
Right. Yeah, I had
the role play stuff behind it. I don't get that.
No. Yeah, I had some similar thoughts with the wild. It's in the same way some of the classes in Player's Handbook 2 were sort of more advanced classes. They were more complex with more little fiddly things that you have to remember and that change. I felt the same way with the wild and as a race. It's a little bit more of an advanced race because there's a lot of different choices and your choices change as often as you want them to change. Quinn, did you have any thoughts on the Wilden?
Yeah. My only problem with the I've got two beefs with the Wilden. One, that first picture they have. Like when I saw the first picture of them there, I sort of I had this sort of revulsion over there, and just like a race of Wolverines. Right, like I just half expected the Wilden to pull out their adamantium claws and go, "I'm the best at what I do," kind of thing with a haircut, kind of stuff. It's funny.
Hey, they are a wisdom race. They could go Avenger.
sorry for the non-comic book readers in the listening audience.
But, turn the page and then it was like, okay, they look more like this. Okay, I can accept that. But that was just my first thing there. Now, on the aspects, my problem with the aspects is that they're also – you'd think the cool thing of using the Wilden is that they have these abilities that you can sort of switch to as sort of like your mood dictates for either mechanical reasons or story reasons. But really – The way the abilities are built, at least to me, seem very tuned to certain class concepts, right? If you're a wizard, or, not that you're going to be making many wizards with these guys, but, some sort of caster class, you're not going to be using Wrath of the Destroyer maybe ever.
Right.
Because that involves you running up and making melee attacks and charging things. And likewise for Voyage of the Ancients, they all seem to sort of exclude the other one. So I don't –
Sure.
To me, when I looked at that, I just don't see how much you'd be switching.
Well, I sort of get the impression that it feels a little bit like they're trying to capture a little bit of the magic of how – well, and of how magic worked in previous editions, right, where you sort of had to customize what do I need for what's going on in my campaign today. And so it gives you a little bit of that back, right? I can choose a specific power that I get to have for today that's going to be particularly useful for the situation I'm going into. But you're right. There's some that, this is going to be good for this kind of class and to the exclusion of the others. Personally, the Wilden are fine, whatever. I'm kind of glad I let you guys go first because I had basically two beefs with it and you both mentioned exactly my concerns with the wild. I'm not fond of the appearance. I'm not even fond of the appearance on the next page where they're more planty than they are cat people. I don't know. They look odd to me. I kind of feel like you could have accomplished something similar with races we have, maybe even do different takes on shifters or something, They seem to fill some of the same space. At least in sort of concept, if I want to play a nature-y based race, I think there's some overlap with some other races as well. I'm just not sure. I don't know. I don't feel particularly drawn to play a Wilden, and I could see myself playing any of the other races that in the book.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever play a Wilden.
I would say it sold us a little more, like, visually on it, too. Besides the problem with some of the pictures in there, there's not actually – when you go through the book, there's not actually a lot of pictures of the Wilden.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of even hard to build up a visual identity for them, And that, to me, is sort of a problem, too. I want to see them in action more.
Sure. and that might save it with time. I think the Wild End is one of those things where in the future they're either going to support it and it's going to make it work, or they're going to say, okay, this isn't what people are really looking for, and they just sort of let it slide by the wayside and they sort of fade into the background. And every now and then you'll see somebody play one, but for the most part, maybe you won't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so are we good on races? Should we move ahead and look at classes?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I actually think looking at the Wild End some more, I may actually build a Wild End Avenger and just go ridiculous Wolverine. I mean, they're wisdom and dex. They get a +2 to stealth. You almost want to. I'd feel dirty, but
yeah, could fit. It could fit,
but only if you name him Logan.
Yeah, that is true.
No, I could name him James.
No, then I won't let you do it.
Which is Wolf? Yeah, Wolverine. That's Wolverine's real name.
What
about what?
Wild and X.
Wild and X.
You know, like off the Weapon X.
That could work.
Or
all right,
or
I think I've built.
Or call him Badger.
Comics here.
His name Badger. But then everybody will start singing a Badger, 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 Mushroom, Mushroom.
And then you kill him. That could be your Oath of Enmity. You're getting psyched up. That's Oath of Enmity.
Okay, we need to move on. Let's look at classes. The first four classes we get are psionic classes, which is our new power source, and then we have one divine and one primal as well. And the psionic classes all have some similarities, or at least three of them have some similarities, in that they use some new mechanics for psionics. And I think it's worth just having a conversation at the beginning here of how do psionics work now? You know, in previous editions, they had these PowerPoint things, and that sort of fueled their spells, but they were still very much like wizard spells, just handled differently on how many you can do and when you can do them. How does psionics work in fourth edition? Who wants to tell me?
You get at wills, and then instead of encounters, you still have your regular at wills, and you get power points to essentially pump them up to bigger and badder effects.
Yeah, I think that sort of sums it up pretty well. You have power points, just like you did in previous editions, but not nearly as many, right? By the time you get to 27th level, you have 15 whole power points. Which isn't a lot, you know. In previous editions, you might have had, you know, several hundred power points by that high of a level.
Yeah.
But you're not using as many power points either, you know. You have an at will, and you get to change out at wills as you go up in levels. So normally, when you would have got in another class where you would have gotten an encounter power, instead you get more at wills to choose from, and then you can either augment it using one power point, which makes it a little bit cooler, or you can augment it with two power points, making it significantly cooler, either doing more damage or adding new effects and that kind of stuff. And so you've just got tons and tons of new at-wills here, and then you can augment all of them with the power points. Is that...
Yeah, and then good thing to note, too, is that they'll refresh each encounter there. So you basically sort of get the... They build the... You'll have the two levels of augment, sort of the baby augment, which gives you a little boost, and then so sort of like right in between an at will and an encounter, and then you've got the two augment, which makes it pretty much a solid encounter power. So they build it there, so you pretty much have the same amount of, like, if you spike, sort of, you know, use, you know, maximum powers there, you're gonna use the same sort of encounter powers as everyone else would have used throughout an encounter. You know, it's a very clever design. I remember looking at the preview of the Scion a long time ago and just going, what's that? This is really weird. And then we went and played it, and it plays out really well. One of the big problems with Psionics in previous editions is you'd have these things where the Scion could just do these incredibly huge damaging bursts where they just blow all their psionic points and just blow up the world. And then, you know, hopefully they landed everything, you know, and if they landed everything, they, you know, left a chunk out of the planet. And if they didn't, then they were out of power points and they were pretty much useless for the rest of the day. And this one lets you sort of spike, pseudo-spike there without being useless for the rest of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a pretty solid build.
Philosophy right there.
Yeah. I think it's they've designed it to be pretty solid and it works pretty well. It's maybe not – it doesn't allow for the wild fluctuations that you had in previous versions where you could really just blow a huge chunk of power points all at once to make something really cool and then be useless the rest of the day, which was part of the fun, right? But at the same time, you can do some of that and you still have some of the flexibility that power points gave us in other editions. But – in a way that balances really well and makes you useful to be part of a party for an entire adventuring day. So let's dig into go ahead.
Just as a quick note, what I find makes them very interesting as opposed to other editions is they get to, because of the at will fare, like if you get a good at will power there, you get to sort of abuse one power in multiple ways. It's very interesting. If you have an at will that's right for an encounter, it gets bloody real fast. So I just wanted to add that.
Go on. Okay, cool. So let's go ahead and start digging into these classes. We are already going long on time, and I want to make
sure. It's all Quinn's fault.
I don't mind going a little bit long on something as big as a player's handbook, but I do want to make sure we have enough time to give everything its due look.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a gander at the Ardent, which is your psionic leader. What makes the Ardent a leader is they have the Ardent Surge. And the Ardent, I guess, it should be explained, they're helping allies by sort of getting into their heads and helping them focus on the fight or charging them full of emotion to make them more effective, and so they're using their sort of mental abilities to make their allies better at what they do. And they get this Ardent Surge, which is basically a cleric's healing word plus a bonus, either a bonus to defenses or a bonus to attack, depending on what your build is, which basically means that their healing, in at least their basic healing, is better than the cleric's.
Not for healing, but overall, yes.
Right. Yeah.
They're not healing more than the cleric.
They're not healing more than the cleric, but they're healing the same as the cleric and doing other stuff with the same power.
Well, the cleric is going to add his wisdom.
That's true. I suppose the cleric's going to get a little bit of a boost. You're right. So that's probably pretty fair. Because the bonus is fairly minor. It's a plus one in most cases.
Yeah.
So you're right. I think you fixed that for me. Good call. We do have two builds.
That's going to be edited out.
No. I'll give you all the credit. We do have two builds for the Ardent. You have the Enlightened build, which focuses more on protection and choosing powers that and mantles, which are sort of one of these class features that give you extra boosts for protecting your allies and yourself. And then you also have the Euphoric build, which focuses more on charging your allies full of emotion, making them more emotionally charged to hurt your enemies. So you get bumps up for damage and that kind of thing. Does that cover the Ardent pretty well?
Essentially, the Ardent is a warlord who got tired of talking and just decided to go into your head and make you run out into the battle and just like, go out, you know what, I'm going to do this instead, and they just insert the command in your mind and make you go.
Will, did you have a thought?
Yeah, I was unimpressed by the Ardent originally because I don't read the powers ever until I want to go and make a character. And then I thought, well, Encounters is coming up. I guess I'll try to make a leader. And I looked at the Ardent's level one at wills just to see what was up.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got some really cool powers. A lot of them are – the class seems to run a theme of I try to melee attack something. And if I hit, this cool thing happens to my allies.
Yeah. It does, and they do a lot of that kind of thing. I think it's hard to really understand where a class can be cool until you start actually building a character in that class, right? There's one that we're going to talk about later on. that seems kind of ho-hum to me until you get into the feats, you know, and then suddenly it's like, oh, that actually makes some really cool choices, you know, but we'll get into that when we get there. Next up on our list is the Battle Mind. This is our Psionic Defender, which is kind of a fighter with mental powers.
Yes, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
He doesn't mark quite as easily, right? But he does have basically an at-will minor power that lets him mark one target, or he can bump it up with his PowerPoint augmentation. But it does it in a burst 3. So you can mark somebody who's not necessarily next to you, which is useful. And then you have a bunch of other powers basically that play off of that mark, right? It's not always just they do something and get an attack from you for not honoring the mark. It's more of they do something and you get to react in a certain way with a shift or with damage or whatever. It's a little bit more fiddly, a little bit more things to remember than a fighter mark, which is fine. It's a little bit more advanced than a fighter is. And I think that's okay because you're also getting some interesting choices as to what you're going to do because of that mark.
And it's the third book, so it's going to be more complicated.
Sure. Although I think actually, from what I saw, Player's Handbook 2 ratcheted the complication of classes up to you know, a difficult level of advancement. And then this one is actually more middle. I'd say the classes, a lot of the classes in Player's Handbook 2 are more advanced than the ones in this book.
Mm-hmm. I could agree with that.
Okay. I would need to see him in play. I just don't know how the PowerPoints are going to compare.
That's true.
The Druid is really complicated.
Yeah.
I can't argue against that.
Yeah, and Sorcerer can be. And Shaman, if you want to do it right, you got to, you know, have a very specific idea of how to do it. And, you know. So the builds for the Battle Mind are resilient or quick. For the most part, they don't have huge differences in class features. I guess to me, it seems like the Battle Mind builds actually mean very little, right? The resilient one.
I think they're huge differences.
Okay, explain.
Between those, if you just look at just the features they get between the resilient and then the quick one. Speed of thought, the second you roll initiative, you can, you know, as an encounter power, you get to shift, move a number of squares equal to 3 plus your charisma, which is awesome. Like, you can basically, at the start of an encounter, depending on how it's laid out, just run up to whatever guy you want and stick to him, you know, and mark and, you know, shift with him and things. And then you have the battle resilience. Which is the first time you're hit, basically, to the end of your next turn, you get resistance to damage.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It's going to be, you know, a matter of you sort of running around or taking hits.
Yeah, but so far as I can tell...
You know, just two different styles.
So far as I can tell, those two powers are pretty much the only difference between the two builds, which is sort of my point, right? You either get resistance or you get to move at the beginning of a fight.
There's not a feat or something?
There might be something in feats, but when I look through powers, I don't see any differences in powers, right? All the choices are equally there. And so when I go through this, I'm like, okay, well, speed of thought seems really cool. The idea of being able to move before an attack seems pretty cool, and the idea of getting a little bit of resistance for one round seems kind of eh. So it sort of seems like a no-brainer to me. Maybe there's something I'm missing, though, and if we can't catch it, the listeners can either leave a comment or head over to the forums or send an email and let me know what is it I'm missing about the Battle Mind that makes these builds so different. Any other thoughts on the Battle Mind or ways to point out that I'm wrong?
It hits with con.
It does.
It's shocking.
You can do that with psionics. You can't do that as easily with other things.
Yeah, I have to say I love Mind Spike.
Okay.
What
is Mind Spike?
One of the Battle Minds at will thing is basically what they get to do to people they've marked. And basically it's not one like the fighter that stops you from doing stuff to your opponents, to your allies, it basically says, okay, go ahead, hit my ally. That's fine. Now Mind Spike, and whatever damage you did to my ally, you now take.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate revenge move.
Yeah. It's only melee one, though.
So you got to be up there in the front
lines. Yeah, you have to stick next. Yeah.
I'm not saying it isn't awesome. I'm just throwing out that you got to be right there.
Yep. Okay, and then the next class is one that I think a lot of people were very excited to see, and that is our Monk. The Monk is your psionic striker, kind of, and we'll get into that, why I say that. First of all, what makes the Monk a striker? It seems to be, it doesn't have some of the big extra damage sort of things that you see from other strikers. You know, it doesn't have a sneak attack where you get to roll a bunch of extra dice, or quarry damage, or even a barbarian where you're doing a bunch of extra damage when you get to do it. It seems like the Monk's approach to doing extra damage is slow and steady, right? I'm going to do a little bit of extra damage every single round. You know, I'm going to do 3 plus strength modifier damage once around every round until eventually you fall, you know? Does that seem accurate?
It's between the rogue slash ranger warlock D6 and the Avenger and who's the other one? I guess the sorcerer, where they just add a static.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's about right. Now, some of their powers are pretty cool, right? They have this full discipline concept in their powers. That I think is worth talking about here, where instead of it just being a standard action or a movement action or a minor or an at will or a minor or a free, in this case, a full discipline action gets you a standard action and a move action. So you can use this power and take this move and or take this standard. And you can do them in, you know, whichever order you want. So you can move and then attack, or you can attack and then move. It's just suddenly the Monk is running all over the place and flipping all over the battlefield and doing all these cool things. And I think mechanically it's a really cool way to pull that off.
Yeah, and I think that's where
I certainly like it better than giving him PowerPoints.
You like it better than PowerPoints?
Well, I just don't think PowerPoints would feel right for the Monk.
Sure. Quinn, what were you going to say?
I feel with the full discipline is where the real promise of the Monk as a striker. Because one of the things, one of the sort of lesser looked at things that's part of the striker role is movement. Is being able to just like run all around, like not be touched. You're just, you know, where I'm over here, I'm over there, I'm over here. Just being super mobile. And the Monk, you know, pretty much hands down has to be one of the most mobile classes in the game.
Absolutely.
There, you know, and the way they build the full discipline is just, you know, it's just really awesome. Like, and you can set up all these like crazy, cause all the different movement options, you can set up all these crazy, you know, multi-hit burst, moving everyone around and really sort of, you know, they almost have, to me, it looks like they, you know, and seeing one in play, they almost have just a small touch of controller to them too.
Sure.
You know, when they have their push powers, they'll run into a group of enemies, shift everyone around, smack them, and then get out of there. You know, they're really fun.
Yeah. And they seem like they'd be a lot of fun. Now, we come to the question, though, of is the Monk really psionic? I mean, we have all these new psionic rules and all these new psionic classes, and they all, at least to some degree, follow the new rules for psionics. But the Monk doesn't follow any of the psionic rules. It doesn't have any power points. It doesn't do any of the at-wills that you augment. It doesn't do anything that the psionic classes do, making me think that the Monk is cool, but it's something different. You know, mechanically, it's not quite psionic.
Mm-hmm. And none of the Monk drawings, none of the Monk art has got the little halo over their head.
Halo,
and
yeah.
Every freaking picture in here does.
Yeah, I was looking for an opportunity to mention how much the psionic art kind of bothers me. Like, individually it works, but bothers me that apparently you can't be psionic without having this odd halo around your head.
Yeah. So everybody knows if you're psionic.
Yeah, because your head glows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess...
Real man association.
I guess, they made the decision that they wanted to make the monk psionic because they couldn't really figure out a way to do ki as a power source and make it different enough from psionic. But it seems to me that they've done that, right? I mean, the monk power...
Just make full discipline.
Monk feels very different mechanically. So why not make it ki and use this mechanic of the full discipline as what's unique about the key power source? I think that would have been a brilliant way to go about it and accomplish things in a great way.
What I heard was they couldn't come up with other stuff.
Yeah, I that's true. One of the things I guess I'd heard is that they couldn't figure out what else would go into the key power source.
Right. What else are we going to make chi other than the monk? We're going to do the ninja and the samurai again. It'll be the whole Asian theme. That's a little stereotyping. It might offend somebody. And why do we need a samurai? We've got six kinds of fighters anyway.
Although I don't know. The Wizards of the Coast people are very creative people. I'm sure they could have come up with something if they really wanted to do it. I think they made a decision that it was just going to be easier to do it this way, and it made enough sense they could sort of justify it, and so that's the route they went. I'm still just a little bit disappointed in that decision, but I can live with it.
Well, maybe another psionic full discipline class will come out.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. And then I can just pretend that they're key because that's, what they really are.
Because you're a game master and you can do that.
Because I'm a jerk.
Well, there's that.
I definitely want to see full discipline or some sort of variant of it make a return in like some other class. I like that concept of the sort of the power is a bundle.
Yeah.
So you could get, okay, when you use this power, here's your move, your minor, your standard, here are the things you can do instead of just, use it as a standard or one action there. Yeah. I think that bundling is really awesome.
Well, and I feel like you could probably do, you could even do new builds with existing classes using the full action to give them a little bit of that flair. I mean, you could do a rogue build with some full action martial arts sort of things going on, and suddenly you've got your ninja. And you can do the same thing with the fighter, and now you've got your samurai,
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yep.
So that's the monk. We like the
monk. I'm just trying to figure out how you would do a range with full disciplines. Like, how would you make any kind of range? What are they going to do with the crazy move actions? What do you do? I get away from it.
It's not that horribly different than the stab and shoot in Martial Power 2. The cool ranger at will where it's, I stab him and then I shoot him in the same power.
Right. But you're talking about whole builds based with like if we give the wizard a bunch of full discipline powers, all the wizards that want to get the only full discipline power the wizard's going to take is the one that lets him get away from things trying to kill him.
Okay, yes. Okay, it works better with some classes than others. I haven't
strikers and defenders. Man.
I haven't designed the whole thing yet, but yeah, it seems like a good striker defender sort of fun thing. I could even see it working with some leaders, but okay, that's the monk. Unless we've got something else we want to talk about with the monk. But I think it sounds like we like the monk.
Nope.
We're just not quite sure if he feels psionic.
Oh, yeah. I've got something about the monk since I was actually reading him in depth.
Uh-huh.
The monk gets the unarmed attack, and you can take the feat to improve your unarmed attack. But all of the attacks I saw of the monk are already they're dice. They're not weapon-based. So the unarmed attack is only for basic attacks.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's not much.
It seems strange to me.
There's not a whole lot of advantage in bothering to use a weapon if they're all going to be dice based off of your, anyway.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of feats that do stuff, but that's it. That's all I found.
There's a few feats, and I guess as a DM, I could give out magic items that are
right.
Weapons that the monk could then still use. Or if the monk doesn't want to use it, it's still useful for somebody else. It's not just something that only the monk can use. So I guess there's some advantage there in adding some flexibility to what the DM can do.
Well, I actually think that's a stub that they left, and I think when psionic power comes out, we'll see that get fleshed out. Like, you know, like that is something that you tend to see in these books when they bring out the new class. You'll be looking at it and going, why did they put that in there? They have nothing for that. And then when they release the power book, they're like, oh yeah, that thing that you thought we didn't have anything for, we actually have
a whole bunch of stuff.
Portion of a book for it.
Yeah. That might be the case too. All right, so let's look at the Scion. The Scion is our psionic controller. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a fairly straightforward class, I think, in terms of, you know, as long as you accept the fact that it works on the new psionic rules, right? What makes it a controller is mm-hmm. that it has controllery sort of powers. You know, it makes people move around and that kind of thing. Although I do find that as a controller, the Scion tends to affect fewer creatures than, say, a wizard. Mm-hmm. It's less about...
Are you counting pumping it?
What's that?
Are you counting augments?
Yeah, I mean, even if you look...
Are you counting...
I looked at augments a little bit. And if you look at the augments, you know, sometimes you get a few more creatures out of it or whatever. But for the most part, you know, you're not creating big bursts and you're not making... your zones that stick around and are doing a lot of damage and that kind of thing, you know, they have a few of them. It's absolutely there. It just seems a little bit less focused in that way. It's more about controlling a small handful of people than it is about throwing out big mm-hmm. walls, you know. Does that seem right?
Yeah, it's pretty much right. They do things to less people, but they do worse things to people.
Yeah.
Than a wizard would do. The wizard's going to do, you know, a bunch of, like, nifty stuff to a whole bunch of people, and, you know, Siam's going to go, hey, you, what? Go attack your buddy. Okay. And that's at third level,
yeah.
Right? They're just sort of getting a mini dominate to make stuff. We ran the Scion, the preview version there for Betrayal there, completely wrecked a dungeon delve. We did just almost single-handedly because they just kept making all the creatures, even on the unaugmented version, just kept putting all the enemies against each other. It's a really good power. It's really fun.
Cool. So they've got the
two. Yeah, that is insane.
Yeah, then they've got the two builds for them. They got the telekinetic and the telepathic build. One moves things with your minds, and the other one messes with people's heads, like what Quinn is talking about there. And those are fine and well. I sort of miss some other builds, so I expect to see, you know, because in previous editions, Psionics, they had specialties, sort of like wizards used to have specialties, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot that are very different than telekinetic and telepathic that I always liked. And so I'm hoping that in future, you know, a psionic power source, we get more of these builds. I'm patient at this point. I'm happy with what we have, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of the old sort of specialties coming back as unique builds.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we move along then?
Yep.
All right.
Sure.
Now we get the two classes that sort of stick out. Because...
Yes.
This is a book about psionics that happens to have one divine class and one primal class. They don't really seem to fit in. You know, everything else is very specifically themed. Even the races. Three of the four races are psionically leaning. Or I guess two of the three are psionically leaning. And so the non-psionic stuff doesn't quite seem to fit. But let's see what's there and see if we like it. Let's start with the Rune Priest. Mm-hmm. Somebody tell me about the Rune Priest.
The whole rune thing seems kind of tacked on to me. I think it seems like they just needed... How are we going to justify another kind of strength-based cleric?
Yeah.
That bothers me, that's all. I've played Warhammer too long.
Well, and I like the idea of the Rune Priest. Like, in, I have sort of the opposite problem with the Rune Priest than I do with the Shard Mind, right? The Shard Mind I really like, but I'm not sure how to fit it into my world. The Rune Priest I really like for my world, but mechanically I'm not always that excited about it. You know, it seems to me, I guess to me it feels like the Rune Priest is a little bit confused. It's supposed to be a leader, but it's not a great healer in terms of leaders. They talk about how it can secondary into controller or defender, but it seems to me that it's actually secondarying into striker a lot of times, because the runic artistry class feature is, if you miss me, I'm going to do some extra damage to you, or if you hit me, I'm going to do some extra damage to you. But it's always all about doing extra damage, which seems a little more strikery to me. So I guess I really like the concept, but it's hard to bring my head around all the mechanics for it and whether or not I like those. I think this is the class, though, that really starts to look good if you turn it to another chapter, because I really like some of the runic feats. There's a whole section of runic feats where not only do they do cool stuff, but the stuff they do is cooler if you the more runic feats you have. You know, if you have one runic feat, you get a plus one bonus to this. If you have five runic feats, you get a plus five bonus to this, and it suddenly starts getting even more awesome.
I didn't realize they stacked like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the rune feats are cool.
So, yeah, I mean, the Rune Priest on its own does not excite me. When you add the rune feats, I start saying, oh, this is where they hid the cool.
Yeah, and I bet you that's one of those things they're going to sort of expand on it later. You know, that you could just blow up a whole set of feats for those, and get some really cool stuff on it. I mean, the Rune Priest sort of fits into a good mold here. I just don't know what to think of it. You know, I mean, I mechanically it's sound. I mean, it's not, and there's nothing, you know, wrong with it per se, but it just doesn't evoke that wow neato factor in me.
Yeah, I mean,
I can think of one thing that's wrong with it.
What's that?
Every encounter, all of their at wills, and every encounter has—it's what the class is based on. Is completely different for, well, not completely different, but it's pretty different for the two different builds. They've more or less pinned themselves into a corner as far as making new builds of this.
Oh, because
if you come out with a third, if you come out with a third build, what are all of the old powers going to do for the new build?
There's not a lot of overlap in terms of the powers being useful for one build and the other. It's either you're going to use this power with this build, or you're going to use it with another build. Is that what you're saying?
Sort of. When every single power has a big kicker.
Yeah.
For which build you are.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's not actually tied to a build, though.
It's tied to your rune, right?
But you get to choose that.
Right. No,
the build.
What Will is saying, though, is that in a future book, when they support the Rune Priest, or in a DDI article, when they support the Rune Priest and they give us new runes. You know, it's not just Rune of Destruction and Rune of Protection, but we're going to get the Rune of Awesome or whatever, you know?
Of Clarity, of Speed, or something.
Right, you get the Rune of Speed, and suddenly none of the powers really are useful if you took the Rune of Speed, right? Because none of the old powers support that. Because there's no kicker for it.
Right, I get that part, but there's this rune master part is you enter in a rune state. Like that's not those aren't builds, the Rune of Destruction or the Rune of Protection. That's just something
you can choose that on a rune.
When you go to use it, you choose. Yeah, you can choose that on the fly.
Oh, that's true.
So they can add another one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're not stuck at
anything. I suppose that's true. Yeah.
So they can.
Okay.
They can just add those, and those,
so it's
that's a cool.
You're right. Actually, yeah.
That's a cool.
Go ahead.
Okay, I misread it, but half of my point is still valid.
No, and I think I get it now, because the idea is that I get to, when I cast Word of Shielding, I get to choose whether I do Rune of Destruction or Rune of Protection. And okay, so Rune of Speed's not on there, but something else I have will have the Rune of Speed, and I can use the Rune of Speed to augment that power. It's more like you're augmenting with a specific rune. So yeah, Will's right. Rune of Speed's not going to augment the old powers, but I don't lose anything by not using it, because I can just use one of the other runes.
Right.
Does that cover it?
Yeah, and I guess maybe when the third rune hypothetically comes out and all the new powers, maybe some of those powers won't support one of these two old runes.
Sure. So I think that's fine, because it's still giving options. It doesn't limit any options. So I think I'm okay with that.
Right.
All right. So
the class is much better now.
Yeah, good. Let's move on to the last full class anyway, which is the Seeker, your primal controller, which we already have one of those as well. But this one works different. This is your, I'm going to call on the power of the spirits and attach them to arrows, which I'm going to shoot at you to create, you know, crazy controllery sorts of things. You know, I'm going to shoot an arrow and it's going to create a zone, or I'm going to shoot an arrow and it's going to, you know, affect a bunch of creatures in a certain way or whatever. Right. Is that the Seeker?
Pretty much. That is the fluff on the Seeker.
So what are the mechanics on the Seeker? How does it work?
Basically, it's got the sort of central build independent theme is the inevitable shot, which is essentially if you miss, you get to redirect a shot to someone nearby,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of nice. And then they each, you know, each build has, you know, one build, the more sort of rangery bow build has one where you can sort of push everyone away and hop off and in the encaging spirits, and then the spirit rebuke is basically a more striker based power for someone using the like thrown weapons kind of build for it, where you can, you know, damage someone who hits you or something or misses you with a melee. And yeah, I mean, basically just the powers are all hit a guy, you know, hit a guy, create a burst of, you know, create a swarm of bats, create like vines, you know, just sort of really mess up single targets and then sort of have collateral damage for all his allies.
Yeah. And that's about as excited as I am about the Seeker.
Yeah, I am completely numb to this thing thematically.
It seems like every power source, they feel like now not only has to have a representative from every role, but every power source also has to have an archer. You know, and so this is the answer to the, or at least, you know, I guess controllers don't really need to worry about, or Arcane doesn't need to worry about that, because they're all kind of ranged attackers, right? But they're all about adding new archer classes, it seems, these days. And because Martial Power 2 did the same thing with a warlord build that was archery. It just seems like this is another archer, and for some reason it's primal. It's the shaman archer.
Yeah, but the warlord was actually pretty cool.
Yeah, we did. It was. And Tome listeners will be able to download that episode tonight, hopefully, before I go to bed, where we talked about that in more detail. All right, then. So let's
don't forget the bard comes an archer, too.
Yeah, and the bard is an archer. So let's go ahead and talk about the hybrid class concept, where you kind of – they kind of give you a list of all the current classes that have been published so far, only they're half classes. They're not really the full class, right? You don't get – you know, you get half the number of hit points. You get half the number of surges, that kind of thing. And then you pick – powers from both lists. You know, you get one this level, you get a power from this class, and the next level you get a power from that class. It's a way of taking being involved in more than one class without going into multi-classing. It's just sort of a different approach to it, I think.
I can't decide how I feel about it.
Well, I mean, it's definitely it's a way to feel like the previous multiclassing rules really just got you a touch of flavor, and it was usually like just a way to get some feature or to get some particular, you know, or to qualify for some paragon path that you wanted to go into, like the whole Avenger Dagger Master kind of thing. And where the hybrid gives you a chance to feel like, okay, I'm really, you know, you want to play a fighter wizard? Okay, we're, you know, here you're really playing a fighter wizard, which is actually one of the, you know, worst combos you can make.
But it's classic, you know, too. I mean, there's a classic tradition of the fighter wizard.
Yes, and the Tales of the Suck will be legendary.
Right, but that character is really cool in the novel. Although, I suppose in the fourth edition,
because it's his novel.
In the fourth edition version of the novel, that the fighter wizard is really just a sword mage. It fills, the same role in that story. But so the hybrid, on one hand, it seems like it's full of potential and it's full of possible unbalancing sort of combinations. It's actually a lot less math than previous editions' version of the same thing. Right, they never called it hybrid before, but it's the old version of multiclassing, or the old version of if you want to go back to second edition, dual classing, where there was dual classing and multiclassing that were different. They accomplished something similar to what they did in second edition, but they've already actually done a lot of the math for you. It's really just addition now. The math doesn't bother me, but it seems like there's a lot of combinations. There's no way they could have figured out all the combinations for all the different powers and all the different classes, that somewhere something is broken. And we're not going to find out until, you know, for a year or so when everybody figures out, oh, if I do this class and take these powers, I win. I've won D&D.
I'm sure Karop is the character optimization boards on WotC are they're working on that
going crazy right now.
But, you know, one good thing, you know, they put in a several sort of nice limiting factors in there, and I think one of the strongest one to keep it from breaking and falling over completely is that most of the class features or abilities that you get when you hybrid only work within your class. So they only work when you're using a power that was designed for one of your hybrid classes. So you can only use your rogue sneak attack when you use a rogue power.
Right.
So no, you know, hey, look, I did a fireball with sneak attack. Can't happen.
Right. And I think the other part that at least makes it difficult to one of the things you got to, I guess, at least consider when you do a hybrid combination is that you don't just get powers from either list. You actually have to go every other one. So if there's a power that you really want from one list, you have to plan that out, you know, several levels before when you started the character, to make sure that you can get that power at the level that you get there, right? I mean, I suppose you could take it later as a lower level power when you should be getting something higher, but that always chased me too, you know?
Yeah.
So it is a combination that's going to require significantly more planning than a typical fourth edition player is going to be used to. You know, you had to do some of that kind of thing in third edition for all the prestige classes, but it seems like you got to do a lot more of it now if you're going to do a hybrid.
Yeah, basically, if you didn't feel that character creation was difficult enough in 4th Ed, hybrids are for you.
Exactly. Okay.
You know, you can basically tinker.
So good. I think we've talked about hybrid. Let's move on to the other section.
I was there.
Good. This section actually finishes off with a bunch of epic destinies. Is there any epic destinies?
Are we talking about those?
I say, is there any epic destinies you want to mention, or you want us to move along? There's more of them. There's mostly psionically based or based in the new classes. You know, there's one for the seeker, and there's one for the rune priest. But I'm willing to just sort of say they're there and move along.
You know, why bother talking about epic destinies when we can talk about skill powers, which are cool?
Right. All right. Cool. So let's talk about skill powers. Quinn, since you like him so much, tell me what a skill power is.
Basically, it's a replacement for a utility power of equivalent level that's also tied to a skill that you have. So if you have Intimidate, when you reach second level, say, you can either take your utility power or you can take a skill power that's based on Intimidate.
Yeah.
And what, you know, they give you – oh, sorry, go
ahead. And one of the places where this becomes really cool is that now you've got a set of powers that anybody can take, right? They're not tied to your class at all. They're only tied to what skills you're trained in. So anybody trained in Arcana can take the Arcane Senses utility at second level. And I think that's really cool. The idea that you can have multiple characters with completely different outlooks and completely different classes, but they can still draw from the same powers, is a design space that they haven't really approached in 4th edition until now.
Yeah, they're all very cool.
Well, all right. They're skill powers. I guess we think they're awesome, and we're ready to move on.
Yep. Well, I just have one. It's a feat-related one, so we can use that to segue. One of the feats is – let me see what it's called here. Yeah, it's just a feat called skill power. And when you read it – let me get to it here. You gain a skill power of your level or lower from a skill in which you are trained. So you just get another skill power. You don't have to give up anything.
It's just you get another. Well, you give
That's
up.
That's what
a feat.
I'm checking on.
You give up a feat.
Okay. Just I'm just making sure, because I thought, oh, that's really cool, and then I remember that a lot of feats that give you a power cost you another power from some other place.
Right. Yeah, that's true. But no, that one, you give up a feat, you get a power. That can be actually really cool. It'd be even better if you could take it multiple times.
Can't you?
It doesn't say you can.
Oh, okay. I guess it defaults to you can't.
I think it does.
Yeah.
So, anything else we want to say about... other than that, I guess there's new feats in the book like we just talked about. Mostly the new feats seem to support the new concepts or the new things in this book, right? Like the ones that affect skill power, the ones that support the new classes or the new races. Anything particularly interesting in feats?
I got one. Two that I'm really excited about because I played a staff wizard for a year.
Give it to me.
One of them, where'd it go?
Summarize it for me.
Let's see. Okay. If you're there, no, that's not it. Damn. If you've got any kind of a staff or a pole arm, it's basically you can go ahead and have two weapon defense if you are wielding a staff or pole arm without having to take two weapon attack. It's plus one AC and reflex shield bonus.
Cool.
And then the other one, I thought, as I looked at this at the game store, I'm like, oh my god, I'm totally getting this next level. Is unarmored agility. It doesn't take anything to get, just benefit while you get plus 2 feet bonus to AC while you're wearing cloth or no armor.
Oh, that would have been awesome for my Avenger.
Yeah, Avengers, monks, wizards.
Yeah.
So I finally can make a sorcerer with a better than a 15 AC to start with. So he won't get hit by everything.
Cool. So besides the new feats that support some of the new concepts in the book, you also have new Paragon paths that kind of do the same thing, right? Each race has a new Paragon path for that race. Each class has a set of Paragon paths for that class. You also get a bunch of new magic items, again, supporting the new ideas. And you get some mechanical things to consider in the appendix for the book. Besides those handful of feats, is there anything else in this book that we should be talking about? Or after an hour and 25 minutes of recording, are we getting close to a point where we're ready to wrap things up?
There are superior implements.
What is a superior implement?
I don't know if you care about those.
I care deeply.
They're way in the back. Okay. They're hidden way in the back. It takes a feat to use a superior implement, but it's like a minor magical effect. Here's one at random. Here's the Deathbone Rod. There, it has the trait energized, necrotic, and undeniable. And what those two mean are energized: when you use an attack power through an energized implement, you gain plus 2 damage if the power has the keyword that matches the energized damage type. And then it would also have undeniable, which is plus 2 against to hit a will defense.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit like trying to, you know, a lot of the weapons that are cool because of these little keyword extra things they get to do. it's giving you some of that for your magical implements as well, it seems. It's almost sort of somewhere in between a magic item and the old idea from third edition of a masterwork item, right? It's more than just a little bonus, but it's not quite enough to be a full-blown magic item.
But you can magic up a superior implement.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. I think that's actually cool. Yeah, it just sort of adds some new keywords to your implement that the fighters have been getting with their axe and what have you all along. Mm-hmm. And they're affordable. You know, they're all under 25.
Yeah, they're cheap.
Awesome.
It's all about costing you a feat.
Yeah, you just got to get up the feet.
Yeah.
All right. Any other random things that we missed in the book that we should talk about?
I think that pretty much sums it up.
All righty. Then let's get to our summary. First of all, we asked some questions when we started off, and I want to sort of address those things to see how successful this book was at achieving its goals. The first question, I guess, is the psionic power source something that we want to play? You know, does this book make the psionic power source work and make it something unique and interesting enough that we want to get into it? Will.
Quinn?
I'd say yes.
No.
All right.
Go, Will.
Quinn says yes. Will, what do you say?
Yes. Also, gee, but...
Right. I tend to agree. The psionic power source is really cool, and so is the key power source that the monk has, despite what they say. And there's also the new options for Divine and Primal. Are these something that we were really asking for, or is it just sort of something that was tacked on?
Primal, tacked on. The Rune Priest, I like the Rune Priest. I just don't like the Rune Priest thing. I like the mechanics behind it. I just don't like the whole Rune Priest angle.
Okay. Quinn, what's your take?
I'm disappointed with both of them thematically.
I actually sort of like the Seeker. I seem to be in the minority on this just from what I've seen from other people there. Seeker doesn't seem to be horribly popular, but I really sort of like it. The Rune Priest I'm much sketchier on.
Sure. And I...
But...
Go ahead.
But, you know, they both, I think, can find a place in a game.
Yeah, and
sure.
I think both of them, both the Rune Priest and the Seeker are fine enough classes, but they also sort of feel tacked on. I feel like they could have done this book just as easily, calling it Player's Handbook 3, Psionic Heroes. But they've sort of set up this tradition of doing three power sources in each player's handbook. And I feel like they sort of wanted to keep up with the three power sources. Whether they did it consciously or subconsciously, I think a decision was made that we need to have three power sources. So let's do some Divine and let's do some Primal. And Primal's an easy one to say we need to do because it's the newest of the power sources other than Psionic. Mm-hmm. And then Divine, they just sort of saw a niche and thought they'd fill it there. So it does feel...
Yeah, but you know somebody out there is crying for the lack of a Marshall controller.
Yes, and I think they're going to continue crying. But what I do think that that these editions of the Divine and the Primal were tacked on. I guess the Primal maybe less so because while the Seeker feels tacked on, the races, we have two races that feel very Primal. And so I can sort of accept that part of it well. But what this book really is this is the Psionic Player's Handbook that just happens to have some other things in it too.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound fair?
Yeah, that's definitely the focus.
Okay.
That's how everyone has, I can think of, has been looking at the third one, yeah.
Yeah.
Just like two was going to be the Primal book. There's not really any other way to look at it.
Oh, but I don't necessarily agree, right? Because two had the arcane and the divine options in two were huge.
Oh, they were way better.
Yeah, I mean, I was really excited about those. I'm not really excited about the primal and divine classes in this book. I am interested in some of the primal races, at least in some ways. Okay, so the last question.
Well, part of that is...
Go ahead.
Part of that is that The two classes that you didn't hear a whole lot about the Seeker. That was kind of a stealth thing.
Yeah.
But you heard nothing at all about the Rune Priest.
Yeah.
In Player's Handbook 2, everyone knew about the Bard. Mm-hmm. Everyone was excited. Oh, they're bringing the Bard back. It was like that.
Yeah.
It was the same for the Gnome.
Yeah, I guess maybe Player's Handbook 2 had some advantages because some of the things they brought back we knew about or we knew of from old standbys from previous editions. But I don't necessarily feel like that's necessarily the case, right? Because some of the new stuff in Player's Handbook 2 was really exciting and completely new. And maybe they hyped it better ahead of time. I don't know. But I feel like they're more exciting classes. You know? But moving along. The last question to summarize is, should somebody or is this the kind of thing that somebody needs to go out and buy Player's Handbook 3? Or do we just say, I've got a D&D Insider subscription, I'm just going to wait for them to release the new options into D&D Insider?
Quinn, go.
I would say you might want to... You might want to wait. Like, I could just see this book being, you know, hitting just right notes for some people and grading on other people there. I really like the psionic stuff, but I mean, if you've got a DDI account, you could probably just wait and sort of test this stuff out. I, of course, own a copy because I buy every book.
Right. But. I'm the same way. and I guess normally I sort of look at this sort of a question and I say, is this a book that has a lot of fluff that I really like? In which case, you're not going to get that on D&D Insider, so I would say get the book. Or is this a book that's all about the mechanics and the new rules, most of which you're going to get in D&D Insider? In this case, it's really all about the mechanics and the rules. So maybe it's worth it if you're strapped for cash. This may be one of those books that you keep your D&D Insider account active and current, and that might be good enough for you. There's some areas where maybe you need the book to look through the psionics rules because, you know, they may not be detailed that well on the compendium. Because, you know, sometimes some of those mechanics and things don't get placed in the compendium, right? So in order to understand it initially, you'll at least maybe want one person in your gaming group to have it so you can look through it and understand the rules. But then once you understand the rules, you don't need to have the book to play the game if you've got your D&D Insider account. But again, I'm not exactly a fair test subject either because I buy everything that comes out. And that's why I'm on the show.
I wasn't going to buy it.
You weren't going to buy it?
No, I wasn't going to buy it, but I was going to wait and get it on Amazon through the Tomes Amazon store like a good Tome listener should.
Good
but I had to go and support my local game store because you were doing the review right now.
Because I wanted you to have it early so we could do the review early. It's my fault.
You cost me $15, Jeff.
I feel horrible about that. All right. So let's go ahead and conclude our look at Player's Handbook 3 with this one episode 129. First of all, I want to thank our sponsor for the episode, NobleKnight.com, as well as our guests. Will, thank you for coming back on the show.
Sure. Sorry I lagged.
Not a problem. And Quinn, thank you for coming on, and why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the exciting things that are happening over at the At Will blog.
Yeah, we're coming out. We've got a bunch of great stuff that's going to be coming out on March there. Stuff on Jeff's article on making characters with character, cursed weapons, more off the grid, non-special uses for common powers, all sorts of interesting stuff, things on character flaws. It's going to be pretty cool on March, and we have some other stuff coming up on April and everything too.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited. The At Will blog has been fairly quiet for the winter season, but we're ramping things back up, huh?
Yep. We are coming out of hibernation, stepping out of our cave, and going for it.
Awesome. All right.
Well, sounds exciting.
Of course, anybody out there listening to this can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums. That's right. It has been a long time since I've been able to say this, but the Vorpal Network forums are back up and running again at vorpalnetwork.com.
Nice.
I'm quite excited.
Wow. How long has it been?
It's been a year. And there's all kinds of different reasons for that, but the forums are back up, and I'm actually in charge of maintaining the forums, so if anything happens with them, it's my fault this time. Well, unless we just get hacked really bad again. But hopefully that won't happen. We do have a new secure version of the site, so we should avoid a lot of those problems. So if you want to talk about any geeky sorts of things, head over to VorpalNetwork.com, and we've also got our own little corner dedicated to both D&D and The Tome Show. So I look forward to seeing everybody there. There's been a few people there that I've managed to get the word out a little bit, like on Twitter and that kind of thing. But now that the word is out on the podcast, I look forward to seeing all kinds of people coming back to the Vorpal Network Forum so I can connect to the community again. So I also hope that you'll consider reviewing the show on iTunes or telling your friends about it, maybe as you go to the D&D Game Day for Player's Handbook 3. And also don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products mentioned on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. All right, so I've probed the minds of two esteemed experts, and I've come to conclusions that even a civilized Wilden would have to take note of. With this, episode 129, Player's Handbook 3 of...
I'm on the wall.